All right, we're going to take a little detour from our topics of the day and bring on what we do all the time here in the program, and that's special guests who are going to fill us in on important topics. And very pleased to bring on a gentleman who was born in Panama City, Panama, spent his formative years there and in St. Louis, graduated from University of Missouri, Columbia, had a bachelor's degree in engineering, wrote a master's thesis on operations research and computer simulation. He then entered the world of telecommunications, serving in various roles such as engineering. He got a patent for a software application. He furthered his education by completing more specific requirements for a Series 3 license, a commodity trading advisor. He actively trades commodities and has developed proprietary software programs used in options trading. So he's got just an incredible background. And he started doing more research into this, and then I think decided, hey, this would be a good topic to start writing about. And he's got a book here that I think is pretty interesting. It's called Escaping Oz, Protecting Your Wealth During the Financial Crisis. And Jim Mascara is joining us right now. Hey, Jim, how are you? Good morning.
Jeff, good morning. Thanks a lot for having me on your show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for joining. Congratulations on the book. And, you know, David Stockman was predicting that the market's going to have a big collapse. Of course, he's a well-known former budget director for Ronald Reagan and stock guru. So obviously, a lot of people think a crisis is coming. What do you think?
Yeah, the foundations for this crisis, if you really want to go back historically, really start around 1971. And there's a little segment in the book where I said that the thing that we should really remember Richard Nixon for, probably more, that would be most impactful to society, was not Watergate, but was really an action he took in 1971 when he decoupled the United States from a gold standard that had been established post-World War II, what some call the Bretton Woods Agreement. When he did that, so again, that was, you know, 1971, August, he really set in motion a series of events that not only had decoupled the dollar from gold, but it started trading currencies freely against one another and really created a wave of a credit bubble, unleashed a lot of speculation that might not have been there naturally, allowed what I call the wizards, and hence the Escaping Oz theme. The wizards are typically those in central banking for the United States. It would be the Federal Reserve. I'll lump some entities of government in there as well, to really have this undue influence over the economy and really create just a series of unintended consequences that now are going to morph into something more catastrophic with and really kind of getting away from the stock market for just a second, just like pension crises, the degree of wealth inequality, and even some of the political rancor that you have today that I know you probably talk about a lot on your show, that I followed up with actually with the book this past spring called Escaping Oz and Observer's Reflections. A lot of those things have economic bases to them.
Jim Mascara with us. Jeff Currier here. Our talk line 504-556-9696. So define Oz, if you could, for us.
Well, Oz, you know, obviously in the story of the Wizard of Oz, you know, Dorothy gets swept up in a tornado and then she lands in this magical, mystical land. And the wizard, of course, is this very powerful entity, you know, that breathes fire, has this powerful voice, you know, everybody's afraid of him. And that's kind of how we've developed our economy as well around the wizards, or the Wizard of Oz, if you will, in central banking. You know, there was periods of time where, you know, the media and Congress sat there enraptured by whatever the Fed chairman had to say. And I bring up an example in the book where oftentimes these messages that are transmitted by the Fed chairman tend to be cloaked in these mysterious words. And the former Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, is married to NBC News correspondent Andrea Mitchell. Well, apparently, and this was actually quoted in a book called Maestro by Bob Woodward, where when he was proposing to her, she didn't even understand that he was actually proposing to her. So the point I was trying to make in the book is that if he has a hard time communicating a proposal to his future wife, imagine how discordant his views, or excuse me, his speeches would be to Congress and the media and trying to make sense out of that.
I've listened to the guy, and he's very unclear, and I completely can understand why even his wife couldn't even figure out what he was saying. I'm looking here at all your books. I mean, you're so prolific here, all these different books that you've written, and a lot of this Escaping Oz theme, sort of this observer's reflections in one of your latest ones here. So just to try to give our readers our listeners some hope here. So you're saying that we're headed for hard times, but if we do the right things, we can protect ourselves?
Yeah, the book that you referenced first, which is Navigating the Crisis, that's really more about financial protection for yourself. If you look at it in baseball terms, you know, we need to really focus from a financial investing perspective, not really worried about hitting home runs, but, you know, maybe we hit the single, we bunt the runner over to second base, you know, taking a more conservative approach. The second book that you just referenced, An Observer's Reflection, I think is really important because after the, you know, contentious 2016 election, I really came to the conclusion, and really before that time, that we don't really view the political spectrum accurately. We view it actually much more narrowly than it's truly defined. If you look at the political spectrum in its totality, on one end you have total anarchy, which means nobody's in charge. On the other end you have the isms, you know, the communisms, fascism, socialism. And what I would submit to everyone is that when we first started with this great nation, we were much further away from the ism side than we are today. And that really reflects both parties. And What you've really set up now, Jeff, is kind of this mentality where, you know, you have closed minds being around closed minds. And as a friend of mine said, when like closed minds realize they're among like closed minds, you know, revolutions tend to start, and revolutions aren't calm affairs. And the more and more I see the discourse in this country, I can see that there's no center to it, but it's because it's all confined within a very narrow spectrum of this broad political band. And the reason we can't really think beyond that is because we don't really know what questions to ask. And that's part of what I did with this latest book, An Observer's Reflections, is trying to get people to think about things in a slightly different way so that when they can, so they can ask the right questions of, you know, politicians, people in the media, and so forth. Because I think that will help center the discussion, because when you move through the next financial crisis, you'll have much more of a clash between politics and economics, you know. And so we want to be able to come through that.
And we know that things can't always just go up. There's going to be a downturn. There's going to be another crisis. The question is, I guess, when and how severe is it going to be? A lot of people seem to say it's going to be pretty severe. Although I'm looking here at some numbers, Jim Mascara, and you've got holiday spending expected to increase, optimism now about the economy at an all-time high. You've got folks hoping a tax cut will spur even more economic growth. So among a lot of Americans, there's optimism. Is that misplaced?
The optimism is not necessarily misplaced, because I think part of it happened on the heels of the election of 2016, where there was the notion that, well, here's this person's coming into office. He's a business person. So he, by default, he's going to fix some of the economy's ills. And again, as I mentioned before, even though he's not a true Republican in that sense, and I kind of define some of the divergence that we really had in 2016 with some of the political parties, where you had strength from somebody like a Donald Trump, who's really not a Republican, and a lot of strength from Bernard Sanders, who's really not a Democrat, kind of embodying these kind of third-party characteristics. But I don't think the optimism is necessarily misplaced, because that's, again, the social mood that's been created, that has been, you know, around certainly since the bottom of the market in 2009. So there's a lot of statistical measures which show, okay, unemployment is, you know, you're near, quote, full capacity, even though we also know that a large percentage of the population isn't working. I saw a statistic.
And Jim, I would just add to that, you've got a lot of people that are working, holding down multiple jobs just to make ends meet, a lot of part-time workers.
Exactly. And part of the underlying foundation for all that is a four-letter word that begins with D and ends in T, and it sounds like debt. And the problem with that is if you look at the U.S. economy since prior around 2010, I saw a very interesting chart yesterday, which I wish I would have incorporated this in my books, is that it actually shows that, you know, there's such a large government participation in the economy that it tends to inflate, you know, some of our GDP figures, or again, what economists tell us, okay, that's the overall health of the economy. We also know that the recovery, and it's what it's been, has been very, very weak historically. And if you subtract out some of this government intervention in the economy, which, by the way, here's where the four-letter word comes in, the government doesn't have this extra pot of gold that has been sitting in the coffers. This has to be borrowed into existence. So when you look at the effect of borrowing since about 2010, you actually see kind of a modified GDP, if you will, that's actually been going steadily downhill and is actually negative now. And part of the problem that I enumerate in my latest book, An Observer's Reflections, Jeff, is that we as a society have really asked government to do way too much. And this kind of gets to what I was saying, that, you know, moving closer to the one end of the political spectrum. We know this numerically because we understand and we have figures that tell us that we're $20 trillion in debt at the federal level, right? And that doesn't even count contingent liabilities. So if you think about what we've asked the government to do and you just look at it from a numerical sense, we've clearly asked the government to do way too much. And then again, that kind of gets into the political spectrum of some of the problems that we have today.
And the question is, you're right, I completely agree. How do we dial that back politically when so many people are dependent on those government services and believe that they're essential? And if you try to cut back, people claim you're heartless, claim that you're trying to throw, you know, grandma onto the streets and be cruel and so forth. So it's really hard to, once you establish a government program, to roll it back.
You're absolutely right. And hence, those are part of the seeds of the crises. Again, when you ask government to do a certain amount, if you look at right now what's going on in Puerto Rico, you know, one of the complaints about from Puerto Rico was, well, you know, the federal government didn't do enough in a quick amount of time. In the conclusion of the book, Escaping Oz, Navigating the Crisis, I mentioned that one of the things that we need to do as a society, and this is not going to happen overnight, by the way, this is probably a generational issue that it'll take probably to repair, or at least half a generation, where you need to start focusing on smaller governmental units, you know, moving that power back closer to where you are. Because the more you outsource governance, what I call there's a very important point I want to bring up that hopefully we get a chance to develop a little bit, and that's the difference between freedom of and freedom from. And when we started this country, you know, we've concentrated on freedom of, as enumerated in the Bill of Rights. Well, now we've asked the government to protect us those freedoms from something. And of course, now we've moved way, way off the edge with freedom from, where we're trying to be protected from speech even. And I listened to something on 60 Minutes the other day, actually two Sundays ago, that was really disturbing. They had a panel that had been assembled. And it was a panel of pro-Trump and anti-Trump people, and they were all, I believe, from the state of Michigan. And one lady said that, you know, maybe we should start to limit some of this free speech thing. And so I thought that was a very kind of a watershed moment, because it just kind of shows you, you know, how much we're reaching out to government to protect us from something, right? And the more we ask the government to protect us from something, you know, politicians are very, very eager to help out and do that. And that means more spending, more bureaucracy, blah, blah, blah. And that's the crisis.
Not necessarily a better outcome, because I've yet to find government solving many problems, Jim. It seems like whenever government gets involved, problems become worse.
It's difficult for governments to solve problems, particularly the further away that problem is from the bureaucracy, right? And that gets into, you know, some topics that I bring up in my fictional book series that I have, where I talk about the deep state, the presidential candidates last year, you know, President Trump has referred to the swamp. I mean, that's part of it. And that swamp exists because, you know, we've allowed it to happen, and we keep asking government for more. Again, more and more of those freedoms from.
You know, let me just say, I'm impressed. I've written one book, and I'm excited about that. You've written how many books here, Jim?
I have three nonfiction books, and I have three fiction books. So total of six.
Wow. Well, hey, that's fantastic. Congratulations. And we're going to link to where people can get more information about all your books, and we certainly want to have you back on the program with us. And thank you so much for being with us. Jim Mosquera with us, author, prolific author. He's got three in the Escaping Oz series that I think you'll find very interesting, then three fiction books as Jim was just saying, also look incredible, and I can't wait to read them all. But right now, we got to roll. We'll come back and open up our phone lines again at 504-556-9696. Right here on Ringside on WGSO, 990 AM, WGSO.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.